Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Good. I'm doing good. My family went to this Regina Spektor concert over the weekend. We were part of her cult-like following.
I know you are. You're incredibly devoted. You're about to sell all your worldly goods and follow Regina Spektor around the country, I think.
We're thinking about it because actually we saw her at Messiah College, which I didn't know existed, but does. I think our timing is good. I think we've caught her, like, just before she breaks totally into the kind of MSM fame. In fact, such is our timing that the morning after the concert, she was on the CBS Sunday morning news. There was, like, a 10-minute segment on her. It kind of reminds me of the way I got to know you before you became famous on Blogging Heads TV, you know?
Right. No, I know. You got in early.
Yeah.
On the Kaus bandwagon.
But it's still early, yeah.
Regina Spektor is this female singer-songwriter. What's so great about her? I mean, I like her album, but it's...
She's hard to characterize. She's very diverse and eclectic. Immigrated from Russia at age 9, but seems to have a thorough grasp of American culture. And, you know, you caught wind of my wife's passion for her, and you emailed us some female vocalist song, right? Who was that? Do you remember?
I'm partial to two female vocalists. One, Rosie Thomas, whose album When Things Were Small just rips your heart out. And a woman named Jennifer O'Connor.
That's the one.
Whose album I'm listening to now is very good.
I got to say, though, I listen to these women, and they just do not hold a candle to Regina. I'm sorry. I think if you think they are comparable, you really need to immerse yourself in Regina's oeuvre.
Okay, I'll take that as an order.
No, she's sui generis. She's an original.
But so is Rosie Thomas. Rosie Thomas, that one album is just incredibly good.
We'll see.
And none of them are hold a candle to the wedding present, so there you go. I'm sure you're recovering from your State of the Union viewing party you had at your house, probably?
Yeah, it was a real...
It's a big event. It's absurd how everything's become a big event. Valentine's Day, Halloween, the State of the Union. The State of the Union is just like a phony event. I had a couple of reactions to the speech.
Before you get to that, can I react to the post-speech part of the speech? You know, the part where they plant the audience, they seed the audience with, like, you know, inspiring Americans and introduce them at the end? Is it my imagination, or is the number of people in that gallery growing at kind of an alarming rate? Is four the all-time high?
It could be the all-time high. I mean, nobody liked the baby Einstein woman. What was she doing there? She got rich, so a lot of people got rich.
Subway guy was great.
The subway guy was great.
In fact, they were all great except for her.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I mean, actually, I would rather that the State of the Union address consisted of nothing but that. I do think four is the record. Go ahead.
There are two parts of the speech, I guess. You can divide it into the Iraq and the domestic. The domestic first. The healthcare proposals were interesting. I mean, we're sort of at a switch point. And I haven't looked at them closely enough, but we seem to be at a switch point where we either dissolve the employer-based system and go to individuals purchasing insurance through some sort of, you know, government-regulated market mechanism, not unlike the Medicare drug prescription plan, which Bush championed, or we dissolve the employer-based system and go to a government-run system, not unlike Medicare. That seems to be the choice, and I don't quite know which side I come down on. It's hard for me to believe that the greater efficiency of private insurance makes up for the fact that, A, you add this extra layer of bureaucracy, and, B, it's an extra layer of bureaucracy that has a financial incentive to screwing you out of the medical care you deserve. So I tend to side with the left and would just favor, you know, fixing Medicare and extending it to the entire rest of the population and paying the bill. Bush's plan does seem to present that choice quite starkly, and it's constructive in that respect. I don't think it's going to pass.
Well, when you side with the left, I just let it go at that and don't quibble. But, I mean, his plan, I mean, the part I heard about is if you don't have medical insurance, they just give you a fixed deduction? $15,000 for a family, right?
Right, correct.
Regardless of whether you use the stuff for medical insurance or not.
No, I think you have to use it for medical. It's a good question. I would think you'd have to buy a policy. You might not use up the whole deduction, but yes, go ahead. One article I saw said that if you spent less than that on the policy, you still could make money on the deduction.
Yeah. One question is, wouldn't a tax credit be more equitable than a deduction?
Yes, that's the Democrats' logic. If the Democrats want to negotiate with Bush, that's the logical step for them to take. Keep in mind that this deduction applies to the payroll tax, too. So it applies to people who don't pay income taxes. Everybody pays the payroll tax.
Hmm.
So it has some benefit for the poor. It's just not as big as for people who are in the top half of the income scale who pay income tax. I mean, 53% of the people don't pay any income tax anymore. Big development that has gone largely ignored.
53%?
Yeah. They pay Social Security. I saw that. It's sort of hard to believe, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
It might be 53% pay more in Social Security than income, but that's not the statistic I saw. I know I pay very little, shockingly little in income tax compared with Social Security. That's because my salary is so vast. It does seem to me that Bush has one thing going in his favor, which is the Medicare drug plan wasn't as big a disaster as people thought it would be. In other words, it relied on these private insurance schemes that didn't even exist when they passed the plan. But sure enough, the market produced some sort of private schemes that most people seem to be happy with, despite an immense paperwork burden. It seems to me it's a legitimate debate, and it's a debate we should have, and I hope we have it. Obviously, the thing I care about most is comprehensive immigration reform. I'm hoping that the vitriol over Iraq is so great that the Democrats won't want to cooperate with Bush on this. I'm pessimistic. I'd say it's 50-50, but I'm all for vitriol.
Speaking of which, in his gallery of four inspiring Americans, there were two blacks and no Hispanics. Was that calculated?
Was the Marine not Hispanic?
What was his last name? I don't think
so. Oh, could be. Well, that is interesting. Both the Democrats, Bush thinks this is going to help Republicans capture Latinos. The Democrats are obviously for it because they think it's going to produce a new generation of millions of Democratic voters if existing undocumented immigrants are allowed to qualify for citizenship and vote eventually. They both can't be right. It's going to help one party or the other. And it's hard to believe that it's not going to help the Democrats more than
the Republicans. Wait, how is it going to help the Republicans?
Because Bush's theory is Republicans are going to be so grateful to Bush for promoting this semi-amnesty scheme that they're going to go Republican in a way that, it's as if the Republicans had championed the civil rights laws.
Well, isn't he more responding to...
Bush is the Abraham Lincoln of Hispanic.
Isn't it more that he's responding to money than to votes? Republican business people like cheap labor, and they contribute disproportionately to political campaigns and have disproportionate influence in Washington and so on. I thought it was more a response to that fact than some kind of,
I think it's both. I think if you talk to Republicans, they will all say that, gee, we're dead if we don't capture more of the Latino vote, because the Latino vote is the future. It's growing. It's especially big in Western states,
right,
which are now the swing states. So that is first on the mind of Republican strategists, is how do we capture more of this vote? And Bush has made a whole thing of it, of capturing more of the Latino vote. So I think it's definitely both. He's worried that the Republicans will be shut out of the Latino vote the way they're shut out of the black vote because of the Southern strategy of opposing civil rights gains. That if they get locked into an oppositional approach, Latinos just won't even consider them. And the Latinos are potentially Republican in a way that blacks aren't because they're, Catholic and, more inclined to pro-life versus pro-choice positions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. a more stable family structure, less dependent on the welfare state of the moment, etc. So that's the argument, but my point is it's sort of a zero-sum game. Either they're Hispanic, either they're Democratic, or they're Republican. It seems to me that it's highly unlikely that adding 20 more million Latino voters won't help the Democrats more than the Republicans.
So what you're saying, the Democrats and the Republicans are embracing basically the same legislation, both claiming it's going to help them.
Well, Bush and the Democrats.
Okay, well, isn't it possible that
his own caucus isn't wildly happy.
Okay, but isn't it possible that they're each going to try to steal credit for it? In which case, they're each right. It's possible that each would be right, that if they can get credit for it, if a credit can be assigned to the Democrats as opposed to the Republicans.
Sure, but they're both not going to be able to take credit, so one of them is going to win that battle.
Right, but they may have different ideas about who's going to win it.
Well, right, but they both can't be right. One of them is
no, but there's a different. But well, no, but there's it matters which thing they both can't be right about. The legislation per se could favor either one.
It's hard to believe that the legislation per se doesn't favor the Democrats, and the Democratic strategy is obviously not to make a big issue of it. If you notice that Barack Obama, when he was interviewed, he said, "Yeah, there are areas we can cooperate with the president, health care and energy." He didn't say immigration because the Democratic base isn't wildly happy about Bush's immigration plan. There are a lot of labor unions that don't want to compete with cheaper immigrant labor. So the Democratic leadership is just going to do this sort of quietly in the dead of night. That's the danger I see, that it won't get publicity.
Well.
But that's why we have blogs.
That is. The new age of transparency.
The other thing is, I thought that was I crazy? Bush
yes,
said
you were. Dude.
Bush said we have a chance to shape the solution. I thought that was a relatively modest formulation that seemed to imply that if the surge doesn't work, at least it'll leave us in a better position. For the sloppy outcome that's going to end the war, I thought this was sort of a newfound modesty. Was I crazy to think that?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think he would strain credulity to put it in much more dramatic terms. He did use the term victory in, I think, the next sentence, but it was something like, you know, we're going to turn events in the direction of victory.
Victory, yeah. It was actually a pretty good turn of phrase.
Put things on a long and winding road toward victory. I mean, what I thought was the masterful sentence in this realm was, he says, "Yet one question has surely been settled, that to win the war on terror, we must take the fight to the enemy." Now, of course, whether you agree that question has been settled depends on what you mean by take the fight to the enemy. One question which almost surely has been settled is that his conception of how you take the fight to the enemy has been a disaster for America, and that was a widespread sentiment among the audience listening to him, and yet no politician can afford to be seen not applauding the line, as he put it, you know, to win the war on terror, we must take the fight to the enemy. And so on TV, it looks like they are applauding his conception of what it means to take the war to the enemy. So that was a brilliant line. And I only
Who cares whether they applaud? I mean, there's all this attention devoted to who stands and who sits. It's all unimportant. What's important is the rhetoric in the coming months.
Then you're saying the speech itself does not matter.
No, the speech matters in terms of whether it convinces the public or not.
Well, wait a second.
The obsessive attention to whether Nancy Pelosi stands or sits and who applauds for how long is insane.
No, but if you're saying does the speech matter to does the way the speech goes over with American TV viewers matter?
No, I'm saying Democrats can applaud that and still oppose it the next day in convincing terms.
No, but here's my question to you, Mickey. How the speech plays with Americans matter?
Yes, but not
it
how
does.
It plays
okay.
With,
I,
not
I,
how
I,
it plays with the congressman in the hall.
Mickey, how it plays with Congress, how much applause these lines get, affects how it plays with Americans.
A little.
A lot. If something gets enthusiastic, thunderous applause and unanimous applause, people think, yeah, this it's working. That's absolutely what a line like that is about. And very and very cleverly. If they applied the brain power they apply to these kinds of lines to the actual construction of a foreign policy, we'd be in better shape.
He didn't get that thunderous applause. I was also surprised that Bush clung to these memes, if you will, like the one you just cited, and also one that the struggle against radical Islam is the defining struggle of our generation, which can't play well in the country. Everybody's sick of that apocalyptic rhetoric. It causes people's teeth to go on edge. And they can't test well. He seems to be pursuing a reasonable policy of the surge to make things better. Let's give it a shot. Let's give Petraeus a chance. And then all of a sudden he says, and I have this apocalyptic clash of civilizations worldview, by the way, of which this is a piece. And everybody says, wait a minute, you're a madman. And he can't say that unless he really believes it, because I can't believe it tests well.
Oh, I think he believes it, but I'm not convinced it's a dumb thing to say. He has to say things somehow associated with what he wants to do in Iraq.
But you can be for the surge without believing that the struggle against radical Islam is the defining struggle of our generation and generations to come.
Well, you may be right that's outworn its utility for him.
I guess this is the segue to the surge, which is, I think his case is pretty persuasive. I mean, Petraeus thinks the surge might work, it might not work. Let's give it a shot. How are we? I don't quite see how it's going to work, but how are we worse off if we buy certain Baghdad neighborhoods a few months of peace, then if we don't?
Well, first of all, the fact that Petraeus thinks it's going to succeed, I wouldn't put a lot of stock in. I mean, Petraeus is a very smart guy.
He said he thought it could succeed in his testimony. He did not guarantee.
But what I mean is, the administration, when it wants to do something in Iraq, it always finds a general who will say he thinks it's a good idea. And, moreover, and it's not like they're sitting there consciously lying, but if you take a general and give him an opportunity like that and say, do you think you can make this work, human nature encourages the general to say yes, right? I mean, I don't know, even though Petraeus is a really smart guy, I just think it's only human, now that he's been given this assignment, to say yes, I think this will actually work. I'm sure he thinks it's the best hope. But that's not by itself saying that. The other thing I'd ask you to do is define what you mean by work. I think it could work in the sense that it could take what would otherwise be a foreign policy disaster on a scale like of 9 and make it a 7. But do you really think that it could turn this war into something that suddenly looks like it was a good idea?
Well, we don't know. 20 years from now, yes. Again, we've had this debate, but take it from
20 years from now. I mean, if you go on long enough, anything can look like a good idea.
Taking it from a 9 to a 7 would be worth it, yes, if it could do that.
Right. Well, I concede, it could be that it's better than some alternatives. I mean, certainly, as you know, my feeling is that the most likely near-term form of stability there will consist in a kind of partition where they've given up on the idea of a strong centralized government and you have autonomous or even sovereign, basically ethnically homogeneous regions. I can imagine a surge being part of a strategy that would get us there with relative grace and in a relatively short period of time. Now, it's not designed to be that, unfortunately.
Oh, well, and this surge doesn't seem to be designed to do that.
Well, I can imagine it evolving into that. I mean, I think Petraeus is a realist, and
how would that be? I'm open to this idea, but I just don't quite see.
Well, if they succeed with step one, which is imposing some degree of order on Baghdad,
right?
Then I guess you can talk about peaceful population transfers and stuff, and in any event start to bring some orderly, if separate, governance to these different areas.
But the goal seems to be to prop up a central sort of.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. Right now, as conceived, I'm not betting on this, even though I think it could bring some short-term relative tranquility to Baghdad.
Yeah. But let the record show that you are now opposing the knee-jerk opposition of all the Democrats. The Democrats, the Democrat, you know, the Democrats and the Republican opponents are just, they're just covering their political asses. The Republicans know the war is unpopular, and the way to indicate to the voters that they're, you know, not completely on board is to post the surge, even though the surge is, you know, might be a good thing. And the Democrats are just like, you know, Andrew Sullivan and Tom Friedman, they're just fed up. So, hey, you know, let's pull out because we're fed up. That's an irresponsible position, too. It seems to me that aside from the, you know, Bush fomenting war with Iran, the surge itself isn't a bad gambit to try.
No, like I said, you know, it could work out. But you're also right that to the extent that it's packaged with, you know, getting more belligerent with Iran, I think it's a bad idea. And that may be part of the packaging.
But it wasn't really part of the packaging last night. There were a few hints about Iran. What I don't understand about the surge is...
No, there were definitely hints about Iran in the speech last night, Mickey. He definitely took pains, I think, more than once to associate Iran with evil. I think you should look at it again.
Compared with his previous twisting of reality, it was mild. But yes, what I don't understand quite is what happens, you know, what happens next. So the Mahdi army is on the run. It retreats south, and we arrest some of its leaders, as we seem to be doing. The Al-Qaeda Sunni insurgents retreat to the north to Diyala. Baghdad becomes more peaceful. Fewer people are killed. Our troops are there. Then what happens? That's what I don't...
Well, first of all, the idea of the Mahdi army, like, you know, moving to another hemisphere or something, I don't think... I mean, all they're going to do is quit wearing their black uniforms and stay at home for a few days. A lot of them are in Baghdad, in Sadr City. And so, it's going to be a classic. They fade into the woodwork for a little while, but where are we at the end of the day? And that's why it's, you know, we have more troops to... I gathered that American troops in these neighborhoods will exert a tranquilizing influence to some extent. How long it can keep them, and I guess the idea is now that we have enough to keep them in some of those neighborhoods, you know, who knows, things could work out. But it's not like all these militias are going to be in full retreat. They're just going to go incognito.
Well, how about this plan? Eventually, they're replaced by international troops.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let me know. We'll
start a sign-up sheet on the site, and let me know when France signs up for that mission.
It wouldn't be France.
Wouldn't be France. It would be more like Poland giving us 7 troops.
Well, wouldn't it be more like Pakistan?
Hey, Mickey, they weren't game back when it looked like, you know, this thing was half the disaster it looks like it is now. Why should they? I mean, after what we did to the international community.
If there were a vicious sectarian civil war, there was Shiites and Sunnis killing each other by the thousands, it would be like Darfur. There would be calls for international intervention. So why can't the international community intervene to prevent that from happening? We'd have to eat some crow. We'd have to admit... We were arrogant and invite them in somehow. Well, the next president could easily do that.
But, I mean, if it's already been demonstrated that the best army in the world can't figure out what to do about it, I just don't know why a lot of people would be vying to take our place.
We figured out what to do to pacify Baghdad. We just can't figure out how we're going to leave and have Baghdad not revert to chaos. That's all.
The other thing is, in the long run, just the presence of foreign troops is never a viable solution. And, you know, one thing about the Mahdi army, apparently they actually are going after al-Sadr's militia people to some extent and his political people. But, you know, one thing that could happen is that the militia just fragments, and by some reports it had been doing that already. And that's not necessarily a better situation than the one you have now, or the one you had until recently, where at least is under centralized control and there's somebody you can talk to. Because in a situation like that, the order imposed is superficial. And the people who are in the militia, they're not going to change their lifestyle, probably. And all of a sudden, there's all these new niches in the realm of kind of organized crime and terror and so on. And so you could just get a more decentralized source of chaos.
That's a good point. It's weird, you know, Kagan, who's the author of the surge, didn't want us to go after Sadr.
Well, with some reason. That's a pretty tall order.
And so all of a sudden we seem to be doing that.
And Juan Cole is certainly predicting that that's not going to come off well.
He is, but
Well, he came closer to getting the overall picture right on this war than a lot of people.
You know, on the you have Iraq the model on the other side saying that there it could do some limited good. So.
And he came less close because he thought the war would work out well, I think.
Well, he was for the war, yes, but he's living there. He has a leg up on Juan Cole in terms of he can walk out his door and see what's happening. If he can walk out the door, which is not always true.
Who knows? I mean, you know, as for the Democrats and how they're playing their position, I agree that it's largely political, and I think it's kind of a mistake for them to engage this whole issue with a whole lot of energy, like what we do now, and get into that argument and kind of position themselves to be possibly implicated in a who lost Iraq debate. I mean, what I'd rather see happen is that we spend time doing what people have been doing over the last couple of weeks, which is revisiting the question of how exactly we got into this war, whose fault it was, and so on. The trouble is that a lot of the Democrats were actually complicit. You know, they voted for it, so they can't play that game. That's actually the most destructive game, I think.
Opposition to the surge is a makeup call for people who supported the war in the first place, which was the bigger mistake.
I think that's right.
The surge is, if it's a mistake, it's not even close to being as big a mistake as starting the war in the first place.
Yeah, but I like the recriminations game that's been going on.
Your boy Chuck Hagel has a lot to answer for in that respect. He voted for the war, and now all of a sudden he's declaring the surge to be the greatest disaster since Vietnam. Well, no, the war was the greatest disaster since Vietnam.
One thing about Hagel, though, I don't know if this speaks well of him or ill of him. In his heart, he was not enthusiastic about that war. And I think he said some things publicly to that effect. But believe me, he was not.
I don't know if that speaks well of him that he didn't have the balls to do what he thought. He's probably kicking himself for not. I agree.
And that's I'm sure he is. He's certainly making it up for it on the Verve front. I mean,
on TV, he doesn't even seem to have shown much thought. They ask him, Do you regret your vote? And he doesn't have an answer. He sort of says, oh, we don't want to go into ancient history. That's hypothetical. His answer is just as bad as John Kerry's answer. He should say, yes, it was a mistake.
But when I think about presidential candidates, I want one who would not have done the Iraq War. He would not have done it as president. He would not have initiated that.
Very few people would have initiated that. Good point. The other thing is that, you know, Bush's speech had a lot more on the Sunni-Shiite split than any previous Bush speech. Although at the end he had this BS thing about how they're all part of the same hideous...
Yes, the Shia and Sunni extremists are different faces of the same totalitarian threat.
But you know, the emerging CW is that... It is not that the Iraq war was a masterstroke because it implanted democracy in the Middle East. The emerging CW, as outlined by Edward Luckbrock, is that it was either a masterstroke because it split the Islamic world into warring Sunni and Shiite factions, so we've divided our enemy, and now that's better for us than if the enemy was united.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tempting thought. I think it's confused. You're seeing that in microcosm with Israel, where I think a lot of people are happy about what may be an emerging civil war within Palestine. In fact, America is basically joining the civil war on the side of Fatah. And speaking of that, there was this other his pro-democracy rhetoric in some parts of the world is going to ring a little hollow when he said, "We're pursuing diplomacy to help bring peace to the Holy Land and pursuing the establishment of a democratic Palestinian state living side by side with Israel in peace and security." I mean, Palestinians may point out they actually had an election. Bush didn't like the winner, and so is now giving money to the loser so that the loser can kill the winner. Now, that's at least the way it'll play in Palestine. And but you're right. I mean, that philosophy is part of what you're talking about.
Well,
there are people who think it's a wonderful thing that we're going to see all kinds of slaughter among Muslims. I just think they're wrong. If you look at the way these things play out historically, when violence of this kind is over, there's always lots of people who are just kind of addicted to it as a lifestyle, and they always go somewhere. And meanwhile, in the end, you know who's going to get blamed for what suffering there is when they have time to pause and reflect on the whole thing. And I would say not without reason. If our own right-wing commentators are bragging that we have managed to seduce Islam into an internal civil war.
First, but I thought you were going to say that it's bad because, in this case, it might be a war fought with nuclear weapons. In other words, Iran is about to get them.
Iran's not about to get them. Iran is, whatever, 5 years away or something. But
okay, well, if this is an abiding split in the Islamic world, it's going to last 5 years. And Egypt is going to have to tool up its own... I thought you were going to say it's going to start an arms race in the Middle East.
I think whether or not you see that kind of strife, you know, you'll see that kind of that reaction. I mean, the possession by Iran of nuclear weapons will make the Sunni states want them.
The other interesting thing is that what I hadn't realized, and what one blogger who I've forgotten the name of argued, is that some of the neocons who pushed the war actually had this divide-and-conquer strategy in mind from the beginning. Apparently, if you look at David Wormser's book, I think that's his name.
Yeah.
It's in there. And that's sort of shocking to me.
Wait, he said we should invade Iraq and so lure the Islamic world into internal civil war?
A chaotic outcome in which the Shiites and Sunnis were at each other's throats would be in our interest. I think, and I was told that this is sort of a standard Israeli divide-and-conquer policy, and that Wormser would just be reflecting
that. I'm told that it's true that in some of the Sunni states, like Saudi Arabia, this dynamic and a suddenly spookier Iran, by virtue of the Iraq War, is leading Sunni political elites to direct rhetorical energy away from Israel as the enemy and toward Shiite Islam. And so in the short term, you know, I can see how people are tempted to view that as good news. You know, I think in the long run, it's not going to be.
And it's not going to be because of all these terrorists running around.
Well, just look, first of all, if there's one thing that Iraq teaches us, okay, it's that when wars start, you know, you never know what will happen. I mean, Iraq was in principle a much more controllable situation than a regional conflagration between Sunnis and Shiites. So first of all, it's just kind of an all bets are off situation. Who knows what bad things will happen? That's right. Why some people just like stability, you know? That's what, you know, realists are kind of derided for liking stability, as if stability is this kind of immoral value when they could instead be talking about human rights and so on. But one thing stability is correlated with is lots of innocent people not getting killed.
But the argument made before the war was that status quo in the Middle East was not working in our favor because there were all these angry, unemployed people who were becoming jihadists and coming to kill us. And I find that that was persuasive to me. I'm not sure the war in Iraq was the solution to it, but stability in the Middle East wasn't working in our favor. Stability in the Middle East produced 9/11.
Well, no, it was a long-term, untenable situation. But the question, and it's easy to sit around and say what a preferable alternative would be, but the question is how do you get from A to B? And I've got to think there's a better way and a more likely way to get to B, to get to the desired state, than to start a regional war and hope that the pieces fall in the right places after a million people have died.
It's not as if stability was a nonviolent situation. Stability was producing terrorism. That's my point.
Stability had produced some terrorism. At the same time, authoritarianism was being eroded by some basic technological forces that we've actually seen at work in all these places and are seeing at work. And there are things we could have done to abet those forces. And if we had calmed down and said, let's work on a time frame of 10 to 15 years because we've got these UN inspectors who can actually determine that Saddam Hussein doesn't have nuclear weapons if we'll give them a chance, then we could have done it that way, I think.
I'll give you the last word on that, because we've already talked for half an hour. And it's time to move on to politics, I think.
Oh, great. Back into your territory.
Exactly. It's the subtle power dynamics of a Blogging Heads episode. I've got you on my turf now, although it's not that I have all that much to say.
But the stakes are so much lower here, Mickey. I'm talking about the apocalypse, and you're about to talk about a mere American presidential election.
Which will impact on what we do in Iraq and elsewhere.
You make a good point.
John Kerry is out.
Yeah.
He dropped out this morning. It's odd that he would have the perspicacity to realize he was a terminal doofus right now, and he hadn't realized it in the previous 60 years of his life.
He is not totally clueless, or else somebody sat him down and had a long talk with him.
Exactly my point. It is deeply suspicious that all these Democrats are suddenly getting a clear vision that they shouldn't run at this moment when Hillary enters the race.
So Hillary promised him Secretary of State, you think?
No, I think Hillary sat down with him. I think some
what did she promise him?
She didn't have to promise him anything. Some operative, you know, may have just, like, used charts and graphs to explain to him why Democrats hated him. You know, he's a case where maybe, you know, the force of reason could have worked.
Well, does his departure help a particular, you think it helps Hillary more than others?
I think it just clears the deck. The more Hillary can, it's weird. According to Dick Morris, I think he's right. Hillary wants a bunch of second-tier candidates to sort of sap strength from Obama. She wants, like, Bill Richardson in the race, and she wants Vilsack in the race, because they'll get, you know, 5% of the vote that Obama... She doesn't want it to be Hillary versus Obama, because Obama might win that. She wants it to be Hillary versus the Munchkins. So this this doesn't fit in that strategy, but so that's a very good point. Why did she do it? Why didn't she want Kerry in the race to siphon his 3% of the vote from somebody? I don't know. Maybe she thinks maybe it's a money thing. Maybe she wants his activists. You know, he has some very talented people working for him. Maybe she wants to latch on to Michael Woolley. I don't know.
Maybe they do compete for the same money, but who was going to give him money? He was dead in the water. I can't believe anybody even was taking him seriously enough to want him out of the race.
He sucks up media space because he was the nominee last time, so people feel they have a duty to cover him. Hillary is weird. I mean, I have the sort of same attitude toward her that I have for Libby Dole. I mean, last time, you know, she looks good on paper, but let's see her get some votes. I guess she's won votes in New York, but that's a slightly weird case because New York is a terminally Democratic state. She's still, there was a new poll this morning, she's still stuck in fourth place in Iowa, which is sort of pathetic. At some point, she has to win some primaries. Now, the conventional wisdom was previously that, well, Obama hurt her because in the big Super Tuesday primaries or the Southern primaries, Obama would steal the black vote from her. The latest polls show, oddly enough, she's beating Obama worse among black voters than she is among white voters. In other words, Obama is like rap music.
I'm a little skeptical of this.
Well, I'm not skeptical. The polls, it's been confirmed now in two polls with fairly, you know, semi-robust results. I mean, what Mystery Pollster says is blacks are skeptical of Obama until he starts to win. Mystery Pollster actually polled for a candidate who ran against Obama in Illinois. And blacks were initially skeptical of him. And as soon as he started to win, they all went over to him. So he expects the same dynamic to happen in the race. As soon as Obama wins the primary, boom, Hillary's in trouble in the black community. So that's not implausible that people would, you know, feel loyalty to the Clintons. But, hey, if, you know, all of a sudden, if Obama seems a credible candidate, not a second-tier candidate, they would be torn. Keep in mind that the second half of Clinton administration was incredibly good economically for African Americans. They made huge strides that they'd never made before. The black childhood poverty rate plummeted. The labor market was so tight that they were just great years. And they're rightly loyal to Clinton for achieving that. So it's not implausible to me that Hillary would be the beneficiary of some of that goodwill. It's also not implausible to me, as several people have written, that they wouldn't regard Obama as black in the same way that the vast majority of African Americans are black. He has no slaves in his heritage. He's a recent immigrant from Africa, or his lineage is traced, in the previous generation to Africa. He didn't pay any of his dues. He didn't suffer much discrimination.
Yeah,
didn't live through Jim
Crow. Don't you think that's reaching a little too deep for an explanation? I mean, how many people responding to a poll, black or white, can really cite many of his biographical details? I think if he has a problem, an image problem among some blacks, it's that he doesn't seem all that black. He's culturally kind of white, right?
Well, isn't that the same point?
No, it's not. It's not the same as knowing that he wasn't descended from slaves. A lot of people in America who are culturally white, I mean, I put that in quotation marks, are descended from slaves. It, you know, happens all the time. There's a difference between these two explanations. I'm talking about just...
Good point.
I'm just talking about the kind of image he conveys on TV and the way it might be perceived by some blacks.
But aren't there plenty of blacks who seem culturally white who are quite popular? I guess Julian Bond would be an example, but he changed his tune halfway through his career.
Well, also he was identified with the civil rights movement fundamentally, and it was also back.
I thought he was identified with the anti-war movement. That's what I remember him starting.
Well, he started out with the civil rights movement. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that may also have been back when blacks could afford to be a little less choosy about their black role models, kind of. I don't know. You know, he was one of the very first to break through, kind of.
But it's worse for Obama if his cultural non-blackness is echoed in his biography, so that when blacks take a closer look at him, this guy that seems more half-white than half-black actually is more half-white than half-black.
I still think, certainly in a general election... He's got, and that's a question. I certainly think he's got the black vote there, but that's a question. Who does better in the general, Hillary or Obama?
We don't know yet. It's possible that Hillary is just going to totally crater and not do well at all in any election because she's not a likable person.
I think Obama maybe has more potential in the general. You know, there's a lot, you know. There's a firm core of just kind of resistance to Hillary, right of center, and I don't know how much of that Obama has right now. It depends on how he develops. That's one he's kind of a question mark.
So. Yeah, I agree with that. The other point the other theme I want to try out very quickly is this party and a laptop theme, which is Hegel has talked about an independent run. I don't think it's crazy that McCain would run as an independent. He's not going to run if Hegel runs, but. If McCain is denied the Republican nomination, what's he going to do? He might try to run as an independent. It's possible that if the Republican Party goes all for comprehensive immigration reform, that an anti-comprehensive person like Tom Tancredo would run in a sort of Buchanan-esque independent run. And what's to stop them? I can't figure out what's going to stop them. All they have to do is gin up some activists, get lawyers in 50 states, get on the ballot, and boom, they're running for president.
Right. What's to stop you, for that matter, now that we have this huge following, Mickey?
Well, that's right. I start with a loyal base of, I think, 3 blogging heads commentators. What stops them is in order to have an impact, you have to win a state. But, you know, or you have to, like, you know, throw a state to another candidate. But it's possible that in a badly split race with a controversial Republican Party and an unpopular Democratic candidate, that a third party candidate could get enough in a 5-way race to win.
Has talked about running as an independent?
I think I read some press clips, yes, where he
Well, he certainly seems revved up about this Iraq thing. I mean, more than I totally understand in terms of how heated he gets when he discusses it now. And I think it's kind of from his heart. It's not, I don't think he's just kind of ginning it up.
Well, Republicans hate him, so if he runs, it's going to be as an independent. That's all I have to say. We should maybe move on to the exciting topic of... Did you have anything more than that?
No.
I feel the urge to talk about Chinese anti-satellite weaponry.
Now, Mickey, you're making fun of this. This is by far the most important... Let's see, is this true? This is probably the most important thing we'll talk about this whole dialogue.
Okay.
And that's why it bothers me that it actually has not received much coverage.
Okay.
Now, I won't spend much time on this because I just spent about 20 minutes on it with an actual arms control expert on the previous dialogue with Jeffrey Lewis. And also, I will post a link to this piece I wrote for the New York Times Magazine about the whole issue of satellites and transparency and stability. But we really are at a crucial juncture, I think, right now. And... whether we do work on a treaty that would ban the further testing of anti-satellite weapons will have a lot to do with the stability and of the world in, 15, 20 years. Because satellites, reconnaissance satellites, on balance, are just a stabilizing force. Transparency is just good, okay? It isn't just that India's in better shape if it has satellites that can spy on Pakistan. It is probably more secure if Pakistan has satellites that can see into India. Because the thing that's probably most likely to lead to a nuclear exchange is uncertainty and confusion on one side or the other about what the other is doing and imagining that troops are massing or whatever when they're not, right. Okay?
And according to Jeffrey Lewis, Clinton didn't pursue such a treaty because he was scared of the Republican Congress. But now we don't have a Republican Congress. So who's going to propose this treaty? Not Bush, I take it.
Well, now we have a president who would probably veto it. I mean, as Jeffrey Lewis also said, Bush is one of his key, like, arms control guys, was out, you know, not just like a week or two or three ago or whatever, was out reasserting his claim that a treaty banning anti-satellite weapons would not be verifiable, even as he knew that we were successfully monitoring China's, that we had detected their past failed tests and that we knew about this coming test. We had verified down the line, if the last year has shown anything, it turns out, it has shown how verifiable a ban on anti-satellite weapons would be, and yet Bush's own guy was denying that it's verifiable at the same time.
Right. Is opposition to such a treaty based on the idea that America can easily retain supremacy in the technology?
Well, that's part of it, which is obviously a complete illusion.
That seems a total illusion.
Total illusion. You know, this gets to actually one thing I was going to say in the previous thing about presidential candidates. One virtue of Hillary not winning is, you know, Bill Clinton is such a great orator, and I've seen him talk. It would, if she were not president or running for president, it would free him up to talk more freely. And this is just a good example of something that a politician or the husband of a president cannot say, which is that America will not forever be the most powerful nation in the world.
It seems to be something Obama could say if he's such a far-seeing giant.
Well, I don't think you can say that and run for president. I think that's a political, I don't know, it's perceived to be a political reality that you can say it.
It's harder for a Democrat, I agree.
It's hard for anybody.
And
yet it's a truth you've got to reckon with if you're going to construct a plausible foreign policy. And in fact, if we maintained our preeminence, it would represent the failure of our ideology. Because, look, if our model for freedom and prosperity spreads worldwide and you send it out to a country like China with 7 billion industrious people, well, they're definitely going to become wealthier than us in the long run. And if they want to convert that to military power, they will. And that's why we have to build now the constraints that would keep them from abusing their advantage in economic power. And But the answer to your question is yes. The illusion that America can stay preeminent, this is, of course, built into neocon doctrine, but it predates that, and it's built into the Pentagon's official space strategy philosophy as articulated back during the Clinton administration.
Why will the Chinese abide by the constraints once they have technological superiority? I mean, then it's like, you know, what's...
That's why it's a crucial...
We agreed to this thing 10 years ago, and it's hurting us now, so we'll keep on agreeing to it.
Well, that's why it's crucial. First of all, that's why we should have acted a long ago, and that's why it's still not quite too late to act, although it's not as good as acting a while ago. And the answer is this. Until you've done extensive testing, you can't have confidence in an anti-satellite weapon. In fact, we now know, or at least there have been reports, that the previous three tests of this weapon were totally unsuccessful by China, didn't hit the satellite, and that even this test took place under very controlled conditions that you would not face in a real-life situation. So they still do not have a weapon that has been successfully tested in a real-world environment, okay? You want to keep nations from developing an arsenal of anti-satellite weapons that they have confidence in.
Good point.
And now is the time to act, but with this guy in the White House, you know, there's almost no chance. Plus, I mean, nobody's paying any attention to this.
Well, this guy in the White House and no Democrat, even one who's not running for president, having the balls to propose it.
Even the knowledge to propose it. I mean, they're just not clued in.
I can't believe Russ Feingold wouldn't propose this.
You know, well, it's just your reaction at the beginning of the segment. Anti-satellite weapons sound so boring, and you have to really immerse yourself in the logic of how stabilizing transparency is. It's just like in so many other realms of life. You know, when you have all these video cameras set up and people have picture phones, that makes robbery a harder thing to pull off.
I don't think it's that hard to get that across. Isn't the bigger stumbling block that people would sort of like to have some sort of space weapons to shoot down Korean nuclear weapons heading toward the West Coast?
Well, these are different issues. We're not talking about missile defense here. We're not talking about something.
So an anti-space treaty wouldn't necessarily cover all weapons in space. It would just cover anti-satellite weapons?
Well, first of all, the weapons are not necessarily in space.
I understand.
This was a rocket launched from Chinese soil.
But you could separate the two in treaty negotiations. That's the basic point.
You mean you could outlaw anti-satellite weapons without outlawing what? Without outlawing missile defense?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, in fact, you would think, although missile defense relies primarily, I think, on ground-based radar, you would think we'd actually like to know for sure that our satellites will be there to see what's going on the other side if we want to have a missile defense system, that this could abet a missile defense system,
well,
right?
But missile defense is destabilizing, so to that extent, satellites are destabilizing.
Well, in that sense, maybe. I mean, I'm not for missile defense, but,
okay.
You know, my preference would be pursuing neither. Mm-hmm. But.
And what you had to add to your dialogue with Lewis is
more viewers.
A call.
Because when you're on the other side of the screen, Mickey, we get the Hollywood crowd, we get the chicks. You know, it's just a much larger viewing audience.
Thank you. Can we talk about Oscars now? Enough of this substance.
Plus, when I convince you of something like this, it has street cred. Whereas when I, you know, convince some liberal arms control guy who doesn't need convincing.
I'm not a good foe on the other side. I'd like to see somebody take you on and knew what they were talking about.
I'll tell you.
Persuading me is not such a great achievement.
Sometimes it seems very hard.
You control my blogging head's paycheck. Keep that in mind. So can we talk about something totally superficial?
Oscars?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have three things to say about Oscars.
Okay.
Both 9/11 films flopped, but Oliver Stone's crappy World Trade Center flopped worse, because at least his competition, United 93, was nominated for Best Director. A justly deserved snub by the Academy.
Yeah, I'm not an Oliver Stone fan.
Did you see that movie?
No, I quit going to his movies after, I think, Natural Born Killers.
Produced by Jane Hampshire.
Of whom I have only the highest regard.
So do I. Her book about it was supposed to be good, too. Little Miss Sunshine, a little too cute.
A little too cute, but when I saw that, I thought, well, you know, the truth is this is about as subversive as a film can get and be from Hollywood. I mean, it's kind of funny. They're billing this as some kind of Sundance breakout. I mean, it's crazy. It's got a number of stars. It's a Hollywood production, right?
And it has a moment of shit at the end where they, like, you know, deliver this. It sort of doesn't end on a transgressive note. It ends on a, gee, we're all family note.
Well, that's
right?
What I said. I mean, that's one interesting thing about it. There aren't many films you describe as subversive family values movies. It ultimately is a tribute to the strength of the family, but from a very much kind of, kind of left-wing point of view. I mean, included in the family are, like, you know, suicidal gay uncle, beloved grandfather who snorts heroin, you know, all the things that left-wingers favor. You know, I thought it was pretty good. Didn't you think it was basically pretty good?
I thought it was basically pretty good. I mean, there are other films that were better. The Queen was a much better movie.
Yeah, it's about all I saw. I just, these days, it seems I see mainly movies that the wife drags me to, and she compelled me to see Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah, well, the girl in Little Miss Sunshine was unbelievably good.
She was good. You're right, a little precious, but a subversive family values movie is an interesting enterprise. Worth the trouble.
My third thought is The Queen, which I thought was a really good movie, is basically a payment to the wonderfulness of Tony Blair. He gets all the good lines. He gets to give a great speech at the end. You see him, basically living a nice suburban lifestyle with his wife. You know, they're constantly being called by the queen in their kitchen where they're washing the dishes. It's like, it's sort of too good to be true. And there is a genuine scandal brewing in the Blair administration of, payola campaign loans for honors. They've actually arrested somebody in his cabinet. Not his cabinet, but in his an aide in his office, a young aide in his office. And I just wonder if, you know, keeping in mind that we, pretending that we care about who wins the Oscar, if the bad publicity for Blair will in fact hurt that movie. Because it'll reveal it as a fundamental lie. Blair being this wonderful sort of person without any cynical or without a cynical bone in his body, basically.
How will we confirm this theory of yours? It seems to me not falsifiable.
It's falsifiable if it wins. If the Queen wins best movie, it's falsifiable.
But I mean, if it loses, there's no way of.
Right. There's never any way of knowing with the Academy. Yeah.
Okay.
Usually it's the Scientologist's fault.
So you've set yourself up for kind of a lose-lose situation. You can't win this one.
Correct.
That's very courageous of you.
I've avoided that in the Iraq War, but I've gotten myself in it with the Oscars.
Nice going, man.
So do you have anything to say with your showbiz expertise?
Anything else on the Oscars? No.
Okay.
Borat got skunked, but I guess there was no natural category for it, kind of, right?
It got some writing award, like Best Adapted Screenplay or something like that.
Hmm. Or maybe for the person who wrote the release forms that they gave the people before they knew what they
were
going to say.
It definitely had the best release.
Yeah, best release forms.
Cool.
Okay, so I'm blogging Heads stuff. I think I may have promised something dramatic last time we talked. Not sure I can deliver. I'm going to trickle the dramatic news out over the coming weeks.
We have to do reader emails too. Don't
forget. Oh yeah. Oh boy, are they on the edge of their seats? Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about reader, not email, but comments.
Comments.
You got a comment you want to?
I have a comment. We had got a very good comment from a guy named on my dialogue with Eric Alterman, where Alterman, if you remember, abandoned race-based. Affirmative action for class-based affirmative action, saying he wanted to help poor people, not black people. We got a very smart comment from a guy named Rob Breymeyer, who points that in housing, race is a significant factor, not class. And my beef with him is that, sure, race is a significant factor. He's completely right, I think, that race is more important than income in housing, and the disparity in terms of how blacks and whites are treated increases as you go up the income scale as opposed to decreases. But liberals never take it the next step, which is asking why that happens. Is it just irrational racism? No. It's sort of rational racism in a way that maybe has to be fought against and maybe immoral, but it's not like just blind prejudice. If you're a landlord and you have an applicant to rent one of your apartments, and it seems like a great person. He or she has a job. He's a stable family. But you're not just renting to that person. You're renting to every person that person might know. And the question is that person going to have a cousin who knocks on the door in the middle of the night wanting drug money? And blacks as being as a group closer to poverty than most whites, that's much more likely to happen with a black tenant than a white tenant. And you have to confront the rationality of landlords who make that invidious judgment if you're going to stamp it out. And that's what I would say people like Breymeyer usually ignore. And you're not going to, you're not going to help matters by adding the additional burden that affirmative action poses is maybe this person has this good resume because people just bent over backwards because of his or her race. It'll help dissolve that kind of discrimination if that burden is removed. That's my only point.
Well, I'm not sure I would say it's exponentially more likely. And wouldn't you agree that people probably, in the course of making these judgments, obviously there are correlations between race and things like crime rate and so on. But wouldn't you agree that people, in making judgments that seem to be based on these valid correlations, sometimes ignore cues that, if they paid attention to them, would mitigate their perception of the correlation.
I don't think you can trust the cue. I mean, a person could. I mean, you know, Charlie Peters has said we're all living next to the pit. Okay, everybody could decline in a spiral of drugs and crime and alcoholism and dependency and wind up homeless and a criminal. But if you're coming out of the ghetto, you're a lot closer to the pit than if you're three generations from the ghetto. That was probably true of the Irish when they were coming up too. And you can be as wonderful as you want. You can't account for a person in your family who might be a crackhead. So I don't see what are the cues. What are the cues that landlords are supposed to pay attention to?
Oh. Well, I mean things like you mentioned, a stable family structure. I would think that's a big one.
Two-thirds, you know, the majority of black kids aren't born to a stable family structure.
That's what I'm saying. So if a stable family shows up, they may not be part of the culture that you're worried about.
But they're still, that's right. Well, but they're still much more likely to have ties to the culture we're worried about than a stable white family. It's the odds are, you know, I would have to be 3, 4, 5, 6 times as likely.
What do you think Eric Alterman would say to this? You guys didn't get into this.
No. It's just a point I've always wanted to make about housing discrimination. That's all.
Okay, I didn't know you were going to talk about this, so I have no coherent reply, except to say that the phrase that will probably get the most attention from what you just said is that phrase, rational racism. If you want to write a book that will get attention of one sort or another, I'd recommend that title, Rational Racism.
I knew there was going to be a phrase I would regret saying.
Yeah, that's the one I would. It's not too late to retract that, Mickey.
There is a rationale for racism, whether or not racism should be banned.
I think a better rhetorical tack for you to take would be to say, you define racism in such a way that you oppose it unequivocally, and there is a rational form of, and you don't even want to use the word discrimination here. You want to come up with another substitute for that. But anyway, that's the path I advise for you, Mickey.
Okay.
As your friend or former friend, depending on how this plays out in the blog.
I withdraw the phrase rational racism.
Yeah. Good thinking.
Rational discrimination, maybe? I don't know.
It is a valid question. The taxi driver dilemma, to put it in its starkest terms.
This has been chewed over.
It has been chewed over. And it's not a trivially dismissible question, the taxi driver dilemma. If you're driving a cab at 3 a.m., do you or do you not draw on any cue that seems to be correlated with the likelihood of your getting shot?
People make that argument in the context of the taxi driver. They rarely make it in the context of the landlord running to a tenant.
Well, because for one thing, the stakes are lower. You know, the landlord's not going to get killed. And maybe that's an argument that the landlord should be a little more generous in the assessment.
Yeah, you should impose a heavier legal burden against discrimination. But my point is, if you really want to stamp it out, you have to confront the rationale behind it. Just like if you want to stamp out drug use, you have to confront the fact that drugs are fun. I mean, you always have to confront the hard case on the other side. Anyway.
Well, you can stress that in the long run, drugs aren't fun. I think it's a mistake to claim that drugs are never fun, which is kind of the approach that some take.
Yeah. Anyway.
So I had comments. I mean, I once again am quite impressed by the level of the comments. I mean, although sometimes you do get this jag of complaints about the audio quality of a dialogue, as has happened recently. Which is fine, you know, for the money they're paying, God knows they should be able to complain. But back to the very impressive comments, my dialogue with Ann Althaus there were two comments, one from John at the Bar and the other from Tyrell McAllister, a reply by McAllister. Both very good. I mean, I think reading our comment section is the rough equivalent of attending a graduate seminar at an Ivy League school, and again, it's a little cheaper. It was just about this thing. Somebody had kindly linked to this talk I gave at the TED conference last year, which was basically taken from my book Non-Zero, where I argue that history has a direction that could be called moral. And John at the bar raised the interesting question, truly good and profound question. Of course, we from where we are going to say that history has had a moral direction because we are products of the circumstance that history has led to, and it has shaped our conception of what is the good. So we're going to look back and say history has been leading toward our conception of the good, right?
Good point. What's your answer?
Well, Tyrell's was pretty addressed one form of the complaint, which is to say that maybe I mean that, you know, yes, this is our conception of the good, but behavior is coming more and more into compliance with it. That's one kind of reply. If the original question was meant at a more fundamental level, what he's really asking is how can we say anything at all about what good is in a moral sense? I mean, he's really posing, in a sense, the nihilistic challenge, I think, to moral judgment in general. What confidence do we have that our conception of the good corresponds to anything that transcends our particular circumstances, right? How do we know we're not just making it up? Why should we think that it actually corresponds to any kind of absolute conception of moral good, which most people think their moral judgments do, right?
I think that's right.
Okay.
And what
I would say is the moral direction I'm seeing is that people, on balance, and there are huge episodes of backsliding, including one we're probably now in, but on balance, if you go back to the time when, the point I note was, and this is noted in Peter Singer's book, The Expanding Circle, which is about this trend, back when, at one point, people in ancient Athens thought that people in other Greek city-states were subhuman, and then the moral expansion came when they decided all Greeks are human, the Persians are not human. And I'm saying we've gradually gotten to a point where people, certainly in a society like ours, would at least pay lip service to the idea that wait a second, people in all nations, of all religions, are people and have human rights and deserve decent treatment and so on, okay?
Right.
You're with me. I would argue that actually corresponds to what we can call the objective truth more closely than the claim that your ethnicity or nationality is special. Okay? And you may ask why.
Why?
It's funny you should ask. If you go back to the time when people in Athens were saying that they're human, the others aren't, and the people in the other city are saying they're human and the Athenians aren't, right? And they both are taking that as being the objective truth. They don't just mean that I am more important to me than you are to me. They mean, in some objective, fundamental sense, I am the better, more valuable thing, okay?
Right.
Well, they can't both be right that that's the objective truth, okay? That leads to contradictions. The idea that people of one nationality are better than the other, that is a general belief among the nations, leads to contradictions. If you're claiming that as an objective truth, it can't be the objective truth. Whereas, when you get to a point where people say, well, wait a second, everyone has some value, and I'm not really special in that way, my nation's not really special in that way, that it has no internal contradiction. That has a stronger claim to be the objective truth. And moreover, you can just kind of look back and see how the initial view was grounded in a kind of egotism that's built into humans and a kind of groupishness. And you can see why natural selection gave rise to it for some reason other than it being the objective truth. And so that's kind of my answer. But the interesting thing, and you can set out to debunk my answer if you want, but the interesting thing to me is I'd never thought of putting it like that until I saw these two comments. And that's why it's like a graduate seminar to read our comments section.
Cool. I can't debunk your answer.
Thank you.
But I'm not quite ready to buy it yet.
Okay, but I do think my further claim is that the world is at a point where, unless people generally do a much better job of transcending these groupish, national, ethnic biases, we're screwed. And that's my ultimate claim, not that moral enlightenment is inevitable, but that it was more or less inevitable that we would get to this point where the alternative to seeing the moral truth is like massive global calamity.
That's
a pretty dramatic note to end on, unfortunately.
That was inevitable?
Yeah, I think pretty close to inevitable. I mean, that's the argument I make in the book, that getting to this point that that's what approaching the global level of social organization does, makes, gives you the choice between chaos and moral enlightenment of that sort, and that getting to the global level of social organization was indeed inevitable. Yes, that's the argument in Non-Zero.
That is, you're right. And you would know.
If I don't know what the argument was.
But you're right. That is the argument. But I don't have a response, so why don't you announce your big news, and then we'll try to get out before we've gone a minute and an hour and 15 minutes.
But we'll serve more bandwidth if we go longer.
And that's all you care about.
It's one thing.
You don't really care about the fundamental equality of all men. You care about bandwidth.
Maybe. Okay, so, oh yeah, big announcements, I claim. First of all, Mickey, Blogging Heads TV is hiring. We're looking for part-time workers, and details can be found, I hope, at a link in the links section. You can click on that, and there will be details.
Can these people be anywhere in the country, or do they have to be in one specific geographic location?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I guess the law allows you to express a geographic bias, does it?
I don't know. Good question.
If you don't know, then I have none. No, actually, I mean, in some ways, there are virtues, depending on the function, to both, because there are virtues of being, it's a long story, come to think of it. There are virtues to being in different time zones and so on.
So people should click on the link.
They should click on the link. You put it well. Okay. The other thing is we're inviting people to submit, like, video op-eds. That's a bad term, because op-ed sounds kind of boring. But
didn't Katie correct Travis?
Did she?
She had a sort of, First Amendment section where ordinary citizens like Rush Limbaugh videotape their thoughts.
Mickey, our viewers are no ordinary citizens, as I think I just established. Right?
No, that's true. Okay. And some of them could do a great job.
Yeah. For that, it's like a video of yourself expressing a viewpoint.
Can it be edited?
What?
Can it be edited?
It's a good question. I think we're not looking for fundamentally... Well, I guess here's my feeling. We should talk this through. It seems to me if you're talking about edited political commentary...
Can it be like Lazy Muncie? You're walking around Muncie and you have a little 2 seconds here, 2 seconds there. Can you be, you know...
Let's just say that the person...
Documentary clips?
The person has got to be on screen and at the center of the thing. And right now, we are not giving points for editing sophistication or cleverness, because so few people would be able to do that, probably. I don't want to do that. It's fundamentally, you know, Matt Iglesias has one today that I'll link to. Everybody's doing this. Josh Marshall did it. You know, their replies to Bush's...
Oh, really? Okay.
So, too, yeah.
You organized this?
No, I didn't organize it. I wish I had thought to.
Oh, they did it on their own sites?
They did it on their own sites.
That's scary. That's competition.
It is a little scary, but I will say that this idea predates that. This is not a response. Not a response.
Nice try.
So, to get details to that, they should email op-ed@bloggingheads.tv.
Can you post that email also on the site?
I guess I can do that.
This is a big deal. I mean, people should... I mean, right?
Yeah, you may ask what's in it for them. We're not going to specify. Some combination of material and spiritual rewards, which will probably be overwhelmingly spiritual. But who's to say? First, I want to see what we get and how long we have to keep encouraging this before we get much at all. And then we'll start talking about the rewards.
But this is like the Blogging Heads Global Talent Search.
Kind of like Star Search. I'm kind of the Ed McMahon of my generation,
yeah.
I would say, yeah.
Exactly. Anyway, I urge people to do it. Put us out of business.
Yeah. But although, in the meanwhile, we will be using your video to draw viewers to our site.
Right. Cool. Those are both interesting initiatives.
So we will like declare like a winner or winners, and something will come to the winner or winners, but I wouldn't expect it to be... Well, we will specify that as time goes on. Something for people to start thinking about.
Respect and acclaim. It's always about respect, anyway.
You know, that's how Regina Spektor signs her name. Respect. S-P-E-K-T.
Wow.
Yep.
That's heavy. And it also gives organic unity. to this.
To the whole Blogging Heads episode, the dialogue.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yep.
A rare achievement. Cool.
Speak for yourself. Okay.
Okay, see you soon.
All right, bye.
Bye.